I'm Bert Cohen. It's time for Portside. Going to? What are we going to do? The Steve Miller Band singing about living in the USA. The USA has always been known for being able to get rich, being able to get very rich, being able to get unbelievably rich. And during the recent campaign, charges were leveled at the Barack Obama campaign by Joe the Plumber, talking about spreading the wealth, that Obama wanted to spread the wealth. And our guest today is Lou Daly, and he is senior fellow and director of the Fellows Program. And we're talking about, has the wealth already been spread, well, not around, but from around to the top? What has changed in recent years with the exceedingly wealthy? What's happened with the basic philosophy that is at the base of huge, huge wealth in the United States? It's not the 19th century anymore. People back then used to think that, well, it's just individual initiative, having extra smarts, extra talent, working extra hard, and you get your just desserts. You get exceedingly wealthy. Well, Lou Daly is co-author of a new book called Just Desserts. He's co-author with another guest I've had on the show, Gar Alperovitz. The book is called Unjust Desserts. And thanks very much for being with us today.
It's great to be here.
Now, let's talk about at first why it's called Just Unjust Desserts. It's called Unjust Desserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance. Now, that's kind of a new way of looking at things, how the rich are taking our common inheritance. Most people don't think of it that way. How did you come up with a title, and what's the significance of that?
Well, desserts, of course, is the common way we think about the, or it's sort of the noun form of the idea of deservingness, whether or not someone should get a reward for something that they do or something that they contribute, or also blame for something that they've done. It's sort of a very general concept in our culture and a view that, you know, it is commonly held in terms of economics, is that, you know, what a person gets back from the market, so to speak, in terms of the income and the wealth that they're able to hold, should be roughly proportionate to the value of their contributions into the economy. So you get a fair return on what you've contributed. And as you say, in the past, that was a strongly held view and continues to be strongly held. And this is where our book sort of enters the picture, continues to be strongly held even as our wealth creation and our economic system has become less and less individualized and more socialized, in a sense. And we focus on, in particular, the role of our expanding knowledge, which we characterize as an inheritance because of the way society preserves knowledge over time. we focus on the role of expanding knowledge in demonstrating, you know, statistically and economically, the fact that our economy is, in fact, highly socialized and less dependent on the kinds of individual contributions that in the past people assumed when they talked about just desserts.
Wow, that's a lot to bite off, shall we say. And let me say a bit more about who you are. And as I say, this book is called Unjust Desserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance, just published by the New Press. And it basically proposes a new theory of distributive justice in the area of, as you say, the knowledge economy. And I would dare say the book suggests not just a new theory of distributive justice, but possible new action, something to, you know, take action on this theory. The book has been described by James Kenneth Galbraith as an elegant work of moral philosophy, a reflection on science, technology, cumulative causation, and the collective character of the commonwealth. It's perfectly timed for the end of the grab what you can era, and it does seem to be the end of the grab what you can era. Noam Chomsky says the book formulates issues of entitlement in ways that have far-reaching implications for a just social order. I thought it was interesting. Barbara Ehrenreich, another great author, had an observation about that you may have intended, maybe not, that it seems like you can see a picture of entrepreneurs and tremendous money people, usually men, hoisting a cherry to the top of an already existing sundae, then laying claim to the entire ice cream parlor. But it fails to recognize the contributions of other actors, people who created this, the infrastructure that exists. Is that a fair characterization of, you know, looking at the question of is it just desserts or not? You know, just putting the cherry on the top, does that lay claim to the whole ice cream parlor?
We think so. I mean, if you take one example of sort of the iconic high-tech magnate of our era, Bill Gates. You know, Bill Gates built a huge empire out of computer code, essentially symbols on a piece of paper. You know, out of that he generated for himself a gigantic fortune of $54 billion, which, you know, is I believe, larger than the total stock holdings of the bottom 40% of our entire population. So you get a size of you get a sense of the sort of magnitude of the kinds of fortunes being generated out of technology today.
You say $54 billion.
$54 billion.
And you know, the word billion gets tossed around a great deal these days, and
yeah.
You know, people forget a billion in the United States is 1,000 million. Okay. 1,000 million. $54,000 million held by one family.
Right, compared to, I think, about $21 billion held of stock wealth, and most of Bill Gates' wealth is his stock holdings in Microsoft, compared to, I think, $21 billion for the entirety of the 40% of people at the bottom of the income spectrum. So it's not only the size of the fortune, but the relative size in terms of the inequalities that result. So if you take Bill Gates as an example, and you know what we tend to see, and I think this is a complicated question of how our culture has evolved and how in some ways sort of capitalism, if you will, has in a sense kind of colonized the Protestant work ethic in a way that has really distorted what's going on in terms of wealth creation. If you take Bill Gates and you just look at sort of the value of, say, the Windows operating system, which is his main product. And we, of course, it's easy to acknowledge that this has contributed a lot to our economic productivity. It's probably contributed something to our well-being in terms of our ability to operate computers and have new ways of communicating and gathering information, keeping us in touch with others and so on. So no doubt that there's an important contribution there that deserves to be rewarded.
It has significant value.
Significant value. The problem is that we see it only truncated in sort of the forward the value going forward from the beginning of Microsoft to now. What we don't see is the fact that Bill Gates began putting together Microsoft and developing Windows based on or from a highly, highly developed plateau of knowledge that already existed in society and that he had at his disposal essentially for free, you know, on the day he was born, or more or less on the day he was born, or every day when he woke up in the morning and, you know, went to work trying to figure out how to create the Windows operating system. He had a highly developed platform of technological capability already there for him to work off of. Most importantly, the hardware capacity, the physical microprocessing capacity of solid state circuitry, which, you know, made it physically possible for algorithmic code to carry out computer, you know, sophisticated computer operations. So the problem with the sort of conventional popular picture of Bill Gates is that we see the value he adds, but we don't see, in effect, how much value and how much, you know, how much, in a sense, society invested in him, in providing him and all of us with the underlying hardware capability that lies at the basis of all computer operations, let alone the kinds of more sophisticated operations we can do with, you know, more and more efficient software. So it's sort of like a useful metaphor, I think, is sort of like thinking about, you know, the person who is the mountain climber who's sort of flown in by helicopter halfway up Mount Everest to some plateau. He can climb to the top of Mount Everest and make it to the top, and you can technically say, yes, he's at the top of the mountain, he made it to the top. But of course, in terms of our underlying values of deservingness, you know, the person who makes it to the top of the mountain from halfway up is a much less deserving person than the one who makes it to the top starting all the way at the bottom. And Bill Gates didn't start at the bottom. He started more than halfway up the mountain. And so making it to the top gives him a measure of, some measure of a reward. But we can't lose sight of the fact of, how much he had, invested in him, in a sense, by society to begin with. And there's, you know, a share of his wealth needs to go back to society to reciprocate for those contributions.
Interesting. We're talking with Lou Daly, author, co-author of a new book, Unjust Deserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance. And I think it's important to stay with Bill Gates for a while, because not only is he Bill Gates, but he's so symbolic of just where we are. I think back to, and Einstein said something about, I wish I could remember exactly, that everything has changed except our way of thinking. I guess that was the atomic bomb. Everything's changed except our way of thinking hadn't. And, you know, to cast the atomic bomb, for example, in terms of, like, you know, 17th, 18th century ideas of weaponry, big mistake. I think back to, you know, the early 20th century, late 19th century, with the discovery of oil. There was that wonderful film, There Will Be Blood, where one guy made some huge discoveries and made a great deal of money. However, the platform of the demand for oil was there. And as you say, the literal platform, the computer stuff that I make use of, I have no idea how it works or anything, but that was there. And as you say, in part of your, you've been quoted as saying that, well, asking the question, how far would Bill Gates have gotten without the knowledge he inherited for free from previous generations? If Bill Gates hadn't been born at all, would we still have the kind of software he built his fortune on, as his many outmaneuvered competitors would have happily proved?
Right. I mean, that's one of, to me, was one of the most interesting areas that we researched, which you're pointing to, you know, the hypothetical question, had Bill Gates not been born, what we're really talking about there is the phenomenon of simultaneous invention.
Right.
This is actually kind of a field of scholarly work looking at the development of science. So the most famous case, although this is actually quite exemplary of more general trends in many, many other fields, many, many other inventions. But the most famous case of simultaneous invention was Alexander Graham Bell. So essentially, a simultaneous invention is when two or more inventors, entrepreneurs, discoverers, scientists, what have you, hit upon the same idea, the same invention, independently of one another at roughly the same time. So right there, there's sort of a curious conundrum in terms of, well, how do you give credit to one rather than the other?
Right.
And in the case of Alexander Graham Bell, it was literally a matter of him, or his lawyer, I should say, beating another inventor, Elisha Gray, to the patent office in 1876 one morning. By a couple of hours. And in fact, several years before that, another inventor who had very similar ideas and arguably even in a better form, Antonio Meucci, would have filed for the patent, but for lack of the $10, I think it was, filing fee at the time. So what that evidence tells me is that what's important is less the individual than the knowledge having reached a point where the next step became obvious, where the knowledge had reached a point where sort of the range of where the technology would go was sufficiently narrowed so that lots and lots of people were able to see what the next step should be. And that tells me, and so you do the mental exercise while you take Alexander Graham Bell out of the picture, and the same thing actually applies to Bill Gates with his competitors such as Gary Kildall. If you had take Bill Gates out of the picture, if they had never been born, would we not have still had the technology? And I think all the evidence suggests that we would have, and so that then calls into question the individual, the importance of any one given individual, whether it's Bill Gates or Graham Bell, in terms of the process of invention. And it really puts the spotlight on the evolution of the knowledge that they were all working with, the knowledge that they all had at their disposal, and that's a gift from society. So it sort of changes, our way of looking at where the value is actually coming from when you look at the evidence of simultaneous invention.
Yeah, there's that old phrase, to the winner goes the spoils. and there have been so many cases like that. Like, it's never been resolved who invented the radio.
Yeah.
Was it Marconi? It was a lot of people rushing to the finish line, all with basically the same knowledge, maybe some, slight variations. But it wasn't that one was necessarily that significantly better so that all the spoils should go to the person who crosses the finish line a few seconds earlier. Everybody else ran it too. And now we have radio. I don't know who invented radio, but we all use it. People make money from radio. It's all about advertising, of course. But does that... I think it brings up really some, as you indicate in your book, Unjust Desserts, kind of moral questions.
Yeah.
Now, Bill Gates, his invention, being there at the right time, getting some nice breaks, it helps society, but it suggested very strongly that it would have happened anyway. The telephone would have happened without, as you say, Alexander Graham Bell. The radio would have happened. These were all in process. And we have people now in various pharmaceutical fields and all kinds of fields all working on the same thing, which is great, competing with one another to get to the, you know, the patent office first, or just to make something here. But, you know, Bill Gates, do we want to attack him because he is rich? The fact is there is the Gates Foundation, which gives a lot of money away. And I think going back to perhaps it's 19th century thinking, the concept of noblesse oblige. If you have a lot, you got to give a lot. Doesn't that cover the problem?
Well, yeah, I think it's certainly in principle a step in the right direction to recognize what was actually sort of originates with Republican President Teddy Roosevelt in our political culture, which is the idea of progressive taxation. I found it to be sort of sad, actually, firstly ironic, but ultimately sad that John McCain, you know, sort of exhausted himself in the final days of the 2008 presidential campaign by repudiating the tax philosophy of the person he claimed to be, who he claimed as his role model, Teddy Roosevelt, in accusing Barack Obama of being a socialist. Teddy Roosevelt would not have accused Barack Obama of being a socialist. So the idea of progressive taxation is, you know, just take Bill Gates. I think this is a very simple idea, and it helps us to establish a principle that we then want to apply more deeply into our economic distribution. So if Bill Gates' mansion, I think it's in Redmond or in on the coast of Washington State.
Somewhere. I've never been invited.
Me neither. If that caught fire, think of the costs to taxpayers, the social costs of what it would take to put out a fire at Bill Gates' mansion. All of the companies from all around would have to come and probably spend the entire night, probably tens of thousands of dollars of costs there to put out that fire. Now, compare that to what it would cost to put out the fire in the tiny ranch house where I grew up. Probably one fire truck, and it would take about 40 minutes, and that would be the end of it. So right there on the surface, in terms of the value, people who are wealthier, people who have more assets, people who have more wealth, cost society a lot more necessarily to protect their property rights. It costs society a lot more to service those assets compared to my assets. So right there on the surface, it's a simple matter of reciprocity that wealthy people who cost society a lot more, you know, I don't benefit very much from the Securities and Exchange Commission. I don't know about yourself, because they regulate the kinds of transactions that I don't have much dealings in.
Right.
Bill Gates, whose wealth is almost entirely made up of securities, obviously benefits a lot more from the SEC and those kinds of agencies than I do. So there, again, very, you know, high wealth entails high costs for society. So right on the surface, it's simple to see that a person like Bill Gates should pay more in taxes than a person like most of us.
Right.
So then the question is, what is all that we know about technology and knowledge and its increasingly sort of central role in our wealth creation? You know, what then, you know, how does that bear on questions of progressive taxation? And I would just say that what it does is to establish the basic idea that as we move forward into the knowledge economy, what one economist that we draw on pretty extensively characterizes as the era of knowledge-based growth, as we move forward in that trajectory, we assume and we argue that, in a sense, the basis of our wealth is increasingly, in a sense, collectivized, is increasingly, you know, can only be seen as a common asset. And so the moral problem is an economy that is increasingly socialized, that is increasingly dependent on commonly developed assets, and yet individually is growing more and more unequal with each passing day. That doesn't make any sense morally. a country that is generating most of its wealth out of common assets should reciprocally be generating an income distribution that is more equal, not less equal. And so we want to put that sort of moral idea into the political culture, and then, you know, with the argument that we should be heading in the direction of more equality, and then go from there in terms of what kinds of policies we need to achieve that goal.
Wow, some interesting points, challenging commonly held points of view. Change never comes quickly, that is for sure. Bert Cohen here on Portside. We're talking with Lou Daly of co-author of Unjust Deserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance and What We Can Do About That. You know, I think about everybody in America, at least, uses the internet, is dependent on the computer. So in a way, that enriches our lives. But we also, it enriches, it takes our money too. We got to pay for it. We usually have to pay for internet access. And the idea that this is something that everybody sort of owns and participates in, and everybody benefits from, to have a very, very few people just, you know, coasting, surfing on the very, very, very pinnacle of the wave. I don't know if that's a good analogy or not, but it just, you're right. I think it's something that we really need to question morally. How long can this go on, given that it seems like our basic moral philosophy about wealth really comes from a couple hundred years ago, and that we really haven't changed that much since
right.
then. So that somebody, if he or she was generally in the old days, he works real hard, does something that's exceedingly valuable, contributes in an exceptional way, then of course he or she should get as much money and wealth as he could possibly get. And, you know, there was a time before we even had an income tax, you know, before I think that only came in the teens in the 20th century. And
right.
and it was argued then that there shouldn't even be an income tax. Well, now we have really, as you say, a new situation where it's not based on digging gold. It's not based on discovering oil. To the largest extent, it's based, I think you argue very convincingly, on knowledge, which is really, really a common inheritance. We all benefit from it. You know, the fact that my kids use computers so thoroughly, it's part of all our lives. Now, should money from my pocket and your pocket and 310 million pockets in the United States all go to Bill Gates and a few other people? And, you know, it raises a lot of questions. You mentioned Teddy Roosevelt before. Well, Theodore Roosevelt. He didn't like being called Teddy.
Yeah.
There's a great quote from him, and certainly a conservative. He said, people who have more income, it's worth quoting, I think, people who have more income and wealth necessarily got more help from society to begin with, and therefore they owe more back to society as a share of their income than those who get less from the market. In other words, the rich earn less of their income than the poor earn, because they benefit so much more from the contributions of society. Such unearned income is the natural moral target for taxation. But then again, redistribute the wealth. Joe the plumber. Ooh, you know, that was a big bogeyman. Every time, you know, what's his name, the former mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani, everything he said was 9/11. After a while, it became that John McCain, all he ever said, just go on stage, say, Joe the plumber, walk off stage. It didn't quite work.
Didn't work, though. That's the question.
It seemed to resonate. I, frankly, as a progressive, was a little concerned that it might work, you know, because I have found through the years, having been in elective office myself, that who is it, what part of society most identifies with the ultra-rich? It's the poor.
Yeah.
It's working people. You know, working people with, like, the Joe the Plumber image would say, oh, you can't spread the wealth. You know, why do you want to tax those who've done well? You know, isn't that a disincentive? And, you know, getting back to the old way of thinking, which may need changing, don't hire taxes on the rich slow economic growth. There's a softball. You're here.
Well, I think that there's actually I have Joe Wurzelbacher's one of his quotes here right by taped up on my desk because I find it to have been interesting. He says, "Why should they, the rich?" And in that he's referring to the top 2% that President Obama plans to raise taxes on, because that's what the controversy was all about.
Right.
Why should they be penalized for being successful? That's wrong, because you're successful, you have to pay more than everyone else. So I think there's two problems with this kind of reasoning, which you can broadly say is really the Republican sort of party stand on these issues.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, evolving over the last 30 years, and a good chunk of the electorate has bought into this basic assertion of taxation being, in a sense, a kind of theft. There's two problems with that. One is what I would call a category error in terms of, on the one hand, looking at taxation as a kind of social governmental process, you know, where, you know, under a progressive model, you take away some from the rich to reallocate into the broader part of society to invest in human capital and other things that people need.
Uh-huh.
So there's a sort of a separate idea of socialization, most obviously in the form of taxation that Joe the Plumber is focusing on. But the underlying assumption is that apart from that and prior to that, there is some sort of pure private economy where individuals just go out, make their effort, and get their return as individuals, and that's the end of the story.
Right.
As if everything strictly came from just the effort of the individual, the intelligence of the individual.
Well, a lot of America is built on the old notion of rugged individualism.
Right, and that's what you're saying, that this is how we used to think, and in some sense that is how we used to think, and in some sense that is how it used to be. The problem is that our society has evolved, our economy has evolved into a highly, highly sophisticated, highly structured economy with all kinds of inputs originating not from individuals, but from educational institutions, from the research funding of government, from all kinds of systems that we have in place that allows our knowledge to accumulate across generations so that our sort of basis of knowledge expands and continues to be refined the more we develop as a society. So the problem is Joe the Plumber doesn't see any of that, and it's an odd kind of almost sort of, as I say, category error to just sort of have the morality of an 18th century farming economy apply to the wealth creation of a 21st century knowledge economy. It just doesn't make sense anymore. So Joe the Plumber's way of moral point is actually, is I would argue, obsolete. It just doesn't apply anymore because the individual that he's putting at the center of everything as a wealth creator doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, it's really tough to change that. And again, I always found it somewhat ironic that the most stalwart defenders of the ultra, ultra rich tend to be poor and somehow identify with that. And you brought up some interesting points. Again, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen, Portside. We're talking with author Lou Daly, co-author with Gar Alperovitz of Unjust Deserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance. And there's some lessons in there about perhaps what we can do about it. You bring up interesting points about nurtured by governments. Nurtured by governments. I think about the late 20th century, the second half of the 20th century, roads, highways. Who paid for that? I did. You did. It's all paid for by everybody, you know, to varying degrees, but it's a commonly held good, like knowledge is now. Now, the government subsidized highways at the expense of the railroads. The trucking industry was very, very powerful in making those changes away from a railroad-based economy to a highway-based economy because it benefited them a lot. So the public good, the common inheritance, serve the trucking industry to a large extent and have served the automobile manufacturers. It's amazing how dominant this private interest has been, the trucking industry, when there have been other options. And, you know, the fact that the government has been there nurturing them. And I think one of the, maybe I'm interpreting it wrong, but one of the things that most people are chafing at now with all the talk about bailing out the big three automakers after we've already bailed out this, you know, insanely incompetent financial sector.
Yeah.
They have been nurtured by governments, and people are saying, I think justly so, and maybe this is the start of something, wait a minute. We've been bailing these guys out for years. We've all been, you know, kind of at the feet of the big three automakers and the financial sector, and all we're serving them. You know, they seem to have a philosophy of ours is not to ask what we can do for the country. The question is, what can the country do for us? And that seems to be the case here. And, you know, I wonder, how can we get that in cross? It seems that, you know, there's this wide platform of highways, of the information highway of knowledge, that there's this amazing new aristocracy reaping huge unearned gains from our collective wealth. I wonder, you know, there's always been rich and poor, and there always will be rich and poor. But I wonder in terms of, you know, if you can picture a graph, how much it has changed. I've seen some sort of a chart where, you know, it used to be sort of a long, slow curve. You know, if you draw the poorest and it's slowly, it rises to the middle class. And Thomas Jefferson remarked on how incredibly important a middle class was to a continued democracy. You know, you can have dictatorships with a few wealthy and everybody else serving those interests. We don't want to go there, I don't think. But I wonder, how much has it changed really in the past, you know, 10, 20, 30 years? And how skewed is it really?
Well, it's changed a lot. And probably I'd put a window of the last 30 years.
Okay.
If you look at income, I think in 1980, the top 1% of the wealthiest households held about 8 or 9% of the total income of the country. And today, they hold about 20% of the household income.
This is the top what percent?
The top 1% holds 20%. So the top 1% has more income than the bottom 120 million people in our society combined. Another way of looking at it is in terms of wealth. Just to give a little snapshot of that, if you look at the sort of non-home financial wealth, individually held financial wealth, so not 401k and homes, which, you know, arguably are rapidly, you know, being depleted as we speak, and so we really need to set those apart and get a fix on those. But if you just look at the sort of the sheer financial wealth, the stocks and the bonds and the trusts and the business equity of our country, the top 1% hold almost half of that financial wealth. The bottom half, 150 million people, owns less than 1% of that appreciating wealth. So 50-1. And more importantly, with that 1% is the problem of basically the working class and a good chunk of the middle class essentially being completely cut off from the appreciating wealth of our society, the capital of our society, and totally reliant on wages, which is, in the age of globalization, of course, a very treacherous road to be on. And so that, to me, is kind of a divide that's emerged in our society over the last 30 years of a big chunk of our society, majority of our society, being cut off from the wealth and totally reliant on wages with all of the downward pressures, you know, in that context, as employers, you know, seek to American employers seek to keep up with globalization. Now, another, I think, very important way of thinking about this just in moral terms is the question of, well, what kind of return are wage earners getting from their productivity these days? And here's a big shift that's happened over the last 30 years. So if you look at 1950 to 1980, which economists refer to as sort of the golden age of American capitalism, it's when we were most productive and when most of the gains of our economy went to the middle class. So productivity over that 30-year period increased a total of about 93%. Wages increased over that same period a total of about 89%. So there's sort of a one-to-one correspondence of wages rising with productivity, which is, I think, how most of us would, you know, think it should be.
Sure.
The worker, the wage earner, should get back essentially an equal return for what he puts in. That's what people, quote unquote, deserve. That's their desserts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since 1980, wages and productivity have diverged. Productivity has continued to go up while wages have flattened and declined. So just to take the window of the 2000s, the Bush year, George W. Bush years, productivity rose a total of 20% since the year 2000. But wages over that same period rose less than 1%. So the growth of the economy that comes from more and more productivity, that's been completely severed from the middle class and now is being enjoyed almost exclusively by people at the top. So that gives you a picture of what people are talking about these days when we refer to growing inequality as both an economic and as a moral problem.
Robin Hoodism in reverse. Take from everybody, give to the top. And there was concern about Obama redistributing the wealth.
Yeah.
I was reminded one of my favorite authors through the years, Gore Vidal, long time ago noted, I think you might agree this is accurate. In America, we have socialism for the rich, bare knuckle capitalism for everybody else. You know, the government has. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's right. Socialism for the rich, i.e., Henry Paulson as Joseph Stalin, I guess.
Well, maybe a little bit less brutal than that physically, but you know, just that the rich seem to have the government by the short and curlies, as they might say. And I remember the hope that was inspired. There was a wonderful speech by Franklin Roosevelt in 1936 when he said, in my first administration, the trusts, the corporations, met their match. In my second administration, he promised, they will meet their master. Now, it didn't quite happen that way, you note. That it seemed that the corporate interest, the trusts, as it was at the time, reasserted their authority. And there's been, you know, there was all that worry, the fear that was being cultivated by the Republicans about Obama redistributing the wealth. Now, my question is that it seems to me that Democrats have long been afraid of such talk, very, very fearful. Say, no, we're not talking about distributing the wealth. We don't want to cut the pie differently. We just want to expand the pie. What is the potential of the Obama administration to actually do something about it, to bring about John McCain's nightmare?
Well, I think the potential is certainly there. It's you know, embodied in, I think, the failure of the McCain campaign, you know, in its last dying gasps, kind of shifting gears from sort of cultural attacks on President Obama, you know, with the Reverend Wright stuff and the San Francisco liberal stuff, where he
right.
You know, clinging to guns and all of that. That all fell by the wayside at the end, and the, you know, the accusation was socialism. This was sort of, I guess, their reading of the polling data suggested this would be the thing that would bring him down, accusing him of being a socialist. Well, it didn't work. And, you know, it didn't work when Barry Goldwater did it to Lyndon Johnson. It didn't work when Father Coughlin did it to FDR in rather more extreme terms than Goldwater or McCain. So I think in both and all, you know, in each of those moments, there was really people, I think, were at the level of awareness of, if not inequality, then the growing risks and instability and insecurity facing the middle class had, you know, had really, in a sense, inoculated minor fixes like what Barack Obama is proposing, you know, slight raise in the top marginal income tax rate, really inoculates that sort of tinkering at the edges of the tax system, whether progressive or not, from the kind of class warfare strategy of that McCain, you know, employed at the end of the campaign, because people are feeling insecure. And if Barack Obama says, well, I'm going to give you a tax break, and one way I'm going to finance that is to take a little bit more from people at the top who have been doing so well. You know, people, I think people saw that as something that was morally, you know, morally acceptable, more even morally necessary to do. And he didn't, you know, he didn't sort of go out on the hustings sort of proclaiming that he is the great, you know, this is going to be the great resurrection of a progressive political economy or anything like that. But he stuck by the principle of progressive taxation all the way through to November 4th. And it certainly didn't cost him anything in the polls. And I wonder if, in fact, you know, his targeting of the wealthy might have actually got him some votes and toward, you know, from people toward the bottom at the end.
Well, there's always been, not always, but for the last over 100 years, this strong populist streak in America from, as you mentioned, there was Father Coughlin, but prior to that, there was, you know, during the initial Gilded Age in the 1890s, when there was a huge disparity in wealth, nowhere near as this, you know, the large amount of disparity between, you know, the rich and the poor. But there's always been this populist impulse, and it's sometimes a little bit scary that, you know, I mean, class warfare, you know, it sounds sort of ugly. And, you know, among the populists, we've had George Wallace 40 years ago, and now Sarah Palin. You know, what about the potential for literally a potentially bloody class war? Is there some other way of handling that? Because there is this anger. And I think with the talk about all of us bailing out the top three for making cars that nobody wanted to buy, and yet we're subsidizing them, what about the potential for, you know, kind of a bloody class war, really?
Well, I think actually what's going on is a kind of a backlash, but one that I think takes the form of the idea of not so much a class war where the poor will just simply plunder the rich like the rich have plundered the poor, but but actually the idea of society getting a fair return on what it contributes to our wealth creation. So when, you know, when the first iteration of the bailout kind of flunked the laugh test with the press and the population, it was three pages long and basically a blank check for the executives of AIG and other giant firms. And it was kind of thrown into Congress, and all, you know, sort of the representative process kind of worked there in terms of people being able to express their opinion to individual legislators, and that putting a real crimp in terms of the votes, in terms of getting the bailout passed. Well, the core principle there that everyone was focused on was, okay, if they're too big to fail, ultimately we need to do something about having such scale of finance in our economy, but that's a long-term fix. So in the short term, if they're too big to fail and society, Uncle Sam needs to bail out these firms, well, we're not going to do that for free. We are going to do that in the form of having an ownership stake or some kind of leverage,
right,
in place in terms of the way the bailout is structured, so that if and as these assets get turned around and start appreciating again, then taxpayers through the government ownership stake will have have a foothold in that wealth in return for bailing them out in the first place. So that's really the principle of our book. We show how this sort of principle of reciprocating society for its contributions really goes to the heart of our whole modern era of economic growth, not just the financial system. But really, that's actually a liberal principle. That's not a radical or a populist principle. That's the idea that Teddy Roosevelt articulated in the early 20th century, where he, the idea that those who are benefiting from society, i.e. the Wall Street titans who will get to keep their jobs probably and have a financial system to go ahead and start making money again, presumably also making loans to Main Street, but I don't see much of that happening. But if we're going to have government there to back up the financial system and periodically huge costs that will entail in terms of when the system gets out of control, well, then society is going to have a stake in that and be able to get a fair return on those privately held assets, but a share of which, there's a social claim on a share of that in return for society's contributions. And so that's the principle I see going forward into the 4 or 8 years of an Obama administration. And I think the fight will be over, how we get adequate revenues, and how we reallocate more of a share of private wealth for social uses in ways that are productive, in ways that are effective for helping the whole economy. That's really going to be the test of the Obama administration, because if he can tax the wealthy and also help our economy get back on a strong footing and begin to grow again, well then, the idea that progressive taxation is going to kill the economy and sort of kill the goose that laid the golden egg, that would be disproved, and that would remove a huge barrier in the debate further incursions on the wealth at the top.
Hmm. We're talking with Lou Daly, co-author of Unjust Deserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance. And just a couple minutes left, your co-author, Gar Alperovitz, has proposed an annual wealth tax of 2% on the richest 5% of households in America. Any clue as to how much money that would bring in, how meaningful that would be?
2% on the richest 5%. We have a proposal that we are kind of shopping around with the book. It focuses on the top 2%, actually.
Okay.
And the idea that we have and this is the question of, one, getting the revenue from the top, but also reallocating it in productive ways
right. That
help society. So we call it a knowledge inheritance surcharge, or knowledge inheritance levy on the wealth of the top 2%. That group has an average wealth of about $1 million, and there's about 2 million people in that group.
1 million, did you say?
They have a wealth of 1 million in that group, and there's about 2 million people in the group.
Okay.
So it's 2 million people with about $1 million per household. Now, if you apply a 2% annual levy on that wealth, this would be $20,000 out of their assets of 1 million annually.
Which isn't much.
Leaving man with $980,000. That would generate revenues of $40 billion annually.
Wow.
And what we would do is to take that and funnel it into a government endowment that would provide public grants up to the full cost of tuition at public universities. And as the endowment grows, because as an endowment, it will have compounding value.
Sure.
With the annual revenues coming from the top. Eventually, I think within 5 or 10 years, that grant-making endowment could completely replace the increasingly onerous student loan system.
Wow.
And so that would mean in terms of our moral argument is simply giving creating free universal access to our public university system, and within that, the knowledge inheritance that society has collectively created across many generations. So that's sort of the main concrete proposal that we have associated with the book, and I think something along those lines is going to happen, just in terms of the sheer need to have a more productive workforce, and to have young people coming out of college without $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 of loans burdening them, which really is dragging them down these days.
Yeah, yes. And I think it could be argued rather effectively that that would build national security and really build our national wealth. Lou Daly, thank you so much for being with us today. The book is Unjust Deserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance, and is published by The New Press. Thank you very much for being with us today. A lot of dessert for thought.
Thanks for having me. It was great talking with you.
All right. Thank you. Bert Cohen here. You've been listening to Portside, and we've been talking about money.
Money. Money. Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the world go round, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound, a buck, or a pound is all that makes the world go round. The clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, money, money. Money, 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 money. If you happen to be rich and you feel like a night's entertainment, you can pay for a gay escapade. If you happen to be rich and alone and you need a companion, you can ring for the maid. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover and you moan and you groan right along, you can take it on a train, call a cab, and begin to recover on your 14-carat yacht.
What?
Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the go round, of that we both are sure. I'm being poor. Money, 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 money. When you haven't any shoes on your feet, and your coat's dirty paper, and your look dirty, when you go to get a word of advice from the fat little pastor, he will tell you the love of a maw. But when hunger comes a rap at the window,
who's there?
Hunger.
Oh, hunger.
See how love flies out the door. Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world. Money makes the world go round, the clinking, clanking sound of. Money, 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 give a little, get a little, money, 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 mark a yen, a buck, or a pound, that clinking, clanking, clunking sound is all that makes the world go round, it makes the world go round.
Portside, I'm Bert Cohen. Thanks very much for listening.